Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today, journalist Dana Goldstein talks about her new book, Teacher Wars, and Christian Prenti tells us why we need more Hamilton and less Jefferson if we're ever going to do anything about the climate crisis. The journalist Dana Goldstein has been writing about education, among other things, since 2007. Her book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession, just out from Doubleday, is a highly intelligent and enlightening look at the politics of public education in the United States. She covers the full history of the topic in this country, from our earliest schools to the battle over edu reform today. Dana Goldstein. Welcome, Dana. Reading your book, I was impressed by how so much of what passes for our current education discourse has such a long history, going back, you know, a century or so, or more. Let's get started in the 19th century. How did teaching become a feminized profession?
Yeah, it's an interesting story because what a lot of people don't realize is that in 1800, most school teachers were men, and it was not really considered appropriate for a woman to stand up in front of a mixed room of girls and boys and teach. But what we see happen is around 1830, as reformers like Horace Mann, who are political centrists, begin to make this argument that schooling should be compulsory and that parents should be forced, in fact, to send their kids to school, that they need to find a way to do this without raising taxes. So what they do is they argue that the teaching profession should be a female one, and women at the time can be paid about 50% less than men. And this works. This idea of teaching as a female job spreads nationwide.
There's also a belief that teaching was more about moral uplift than it was about intellectual content, wasn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And at the time, a big concern of education reformers in the 19th century was Catholic immigration and what they saw as the threat of increased religious diversity. And they really hoped that the ideal teacher would be this self-abnegating, pure, moral, Protestant young woman. And she would bring this WASP morality with her into the classroom, and this would Americanize these Catholic immigrants.
Yeah, this is something I often bring up when I interview people on the subject of education and education reform. And you touch upon this, particularly in the early part of the book. We lament the problems of our schools, yet in many ways this is a deeply anti-intellectual culture. What do you think the influence of that is on our educational system?
So when I first got started with this project in 2011, Richard Hofstadter's Anti-Intellectualism in American Life was a huge influence on me, an inspiration to do the book, because, you know, he has a couple chapters in there about teachers in schools, and his ideas are just so relevant today. I mean, I don't think you can look at American schooling in comparison to schooling in other Western nations and not come to the conclusion that the anti-intellectualism that pervades our cultural and political life affects the status of the teaching profession and, in fact, what is taught in schools. We see this huge resistance right now to the Common Core standards, and they're really controversial. It would be going off on a whole tangent to debate them now, but, you know, I actually believe the standards themselves are pretty good, and the attacks we see on them from both the right and the left often have this anti-intellectual flavor, like, we can't ask more of kids, and, you know, that, I think, is a very old idea that dates back to this idea of schools and teachers as moral influences on the child more than intellectual or academic influences.
Another thing that another one of these timeless features of American educational reform is metrics. And you know, we go back 100 years to the Progressive Era. They were doing many things similar to what's being tried today. What was the school reform of the Progressive Era like?
Yeah, so that was one of the big surprises and sort of light bulb moments in doing the research for this book. Today we have something called value-added measurement of teachers, which is using children's test scores to judge, rate, and sometimes pay, fire, hire teachers. Back in the 1920s, it was called the pupil change method. It was calculated in a very similar way to value-added today, and we saw it being put into reformers' plans as a tool to make it, you know, more possible to pay teachers according to merit. If you go back to Atlanta in 1915, you see a merit pay program for teachers instituted, and what happens over the few years that they try it is that overall teacher pay in the Atlanta schools goes down. So under the guise of paying teachers and rewarding good teaching and punishing bad teaching, you actually see a budget-cutting measure underneath that. and that was not unusual in the Progressive era.
And what caused it to be abandoned?
The teachers' unions, which had just gotten started at that time, were very effective at organizing, sometimes very aggressive at organizing against these measures. But a secondary factor was that when they looked at the data coming in from the pupil change method, they saw about 3 percentage points of difference between the best teacher and the average teacher. And when I read that in a peer review from the 1930s, I kind of like had to smile to myself, because we have some research from today showing that Teach for America teachers are how many percentage points more effective at math? 3 percentage points. So, yes, there is a measurable difference between a good teacher and an average teacher, but, you know, throughout history, these are very small distinctions that these tools allow us to make.
Which takes me to another sort of timeless theme. It does seem that we expect schools to do things that they really can't do. I mean, we have a society that's extremely polarized, deeply anti-intellectual, yet we expect the school somehow to cure poverty and, make everybody literate and numerate. Are we just expecting too much of schools?
Well, we do expect an unusual big amount of stuff from our schools. That's not very articulate, but, you know, what I mean by that is that America is a country that has been beset by inequality from the beginning. We have a weak social safety net, and we've consistently looked at teachers to make up for that, whether it's, you know, in the beginning, it's the differences between Catholics and Protestants. In the Progressive era, it's the differences between new immigrants and the mainstream. Going into the civil rights era, it's the black-white achievement gap, and today we talk about this mostly in terms of class. And, you know, we have data on this. We know that about 2/3 of the achievement gap between poor and middle-class kids is driven by out-of-school factors, by the family and by the neighborhood. And the smaller amount of the gap is driven by differences in teacher and school quality. Now, I think it's important to say that teachers and schools do make a difference, and I try to be very clear about that in the book. I wouldn't have devoted my career to writing and covering education as a journalist if I didn't think it mattered. But it is a secondary influence, and oftentimes we don't acknowledge that.
But we have these myths, movies, books about heroic teachers who then are life transformative, and I think we generalize from that to think that we can create a teacher corps that would be society transformative?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Doug. So we know that individual teachers constantly, all the time, have transformative impacts on individual children's lives. But what we often do is jump from that to a macroeconomic argument that teachers are the society-wide fix for poverty and inequality. And the data simply does not back that.
What does the data say?
Well, there's this really interesting study from Raj Chetty, John Friedman, and Jonah Rokoff. They're 3 leading younger economists. They find that about 8% of the current achievement gap is driven by teachers, and the rest of it is driven by all the other factors, family, neighborhood, poverty, the things you would expect. And this particular study is interesting because instead of just looking at test scores, what they found is that, you know, teachers who were effective in the classroom did have these good impacts on children's lifetime earnings, on whether kids were able to avoid teen parenthood, how likely children were to enroll in college. So they took that next step, not just obsessively focusing on test scores, but looking at teachers who have these long-term positive life impacts.
I was struck by one passage in your book. You talk about how there's this universal belief or near universal belief that integration didn't work. But the evidence is that school integration does, in fact, improve results. We have, especially in the North, schools that are deeply segregated by race and class because of residential patterns. What is the impact of this kind of race and class segregation on educational outcomes?
Yeah, so we know that the New York schools are the most segregated in the nation, actually. And generally, you know, Northern schools were never integrated because the courts did not require this. They only really required the South to integrate their schools. But we know that integration is associated with better outcomes, especially for poor children, and it does not negatively impact outcomes for middle-class children. We see in places like Maryland and North Carolina, where some of the research has been done that I cite in my book, that, you know, in an integrated setting, kids are experiencing up to 8% of achievement gains. And if you look at the kind of impacts that teacher-focused reforms have, it's kind of the same, or sometimes integration looks to be even more powerful. And yet all the focus we have on teacher effectiveness has been painted as kind of the next step because integration didn't work. And, you know, what I try to show with the research I cite in the book is that actually, well, integration did work. And, you know, teacher effectiveness should be alongside integration, not as a replacement for it.
I'm speaking with Data Goldstein, author of The Teacher Wars, just out for Doubleday. Let's start focusing on the present now. There seems to be a belief, widespread belief, that teachers need more carrots and more sticks. That is, they have to be easier to fire, and then the good ones have to be rewarded with merit pay. First of all, the issue around tenure and difficulty firing. Tenure predates teachers' unions, right?
Yeah, so actually, tenure predates teachers' unions in other countries. It's an idea that was originally borrowed from the Prussian education system. And early teachers' unions do argue for this. We see the teachers' unions born in 1897, and then the first state that tries tenure is New Jersey in 1909. But one of the things I write about in the book is that reformers, education reformers back in the Progressive era, they loved tenure. One of the reasons why is because they wanted more men to do the job of teaching, and they felt that, you know, giving these great benefits like pensions and tenure would help attract men into the classroom and offset the low pay.
But it's also, teaching was used as a political patronage reward too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see teachers hired and fired for ridiculous reasons back then, like the city alderman's sister-in-law gets the teaching job in Chicago. You saw women teachers getting fired when they got pregnant, black teachers losing their jobs, and then later on, Quakers and communist teachers are sort of witch-hunted en masse. During the different waves of the Red Scare. So a lot of sensible people would observe this politicization of the classroom and concluded that tenure was actually a good government reform. So it was a very different discussion about tenure back then than we have today.
And even under the current tenure-dominant system, teachers are fired, or teachers do leave the field. It's not it's not a lifetime sinecure.
No, it's not. All it means, of course, is due process, that if the administration wants to get rid of you, they have to, you know, summon up the evidence and present it to some sort of neutral arbitrator that's going to make a decision. Of course, in practice, that can be complicated because there's an appeals process and it can get very lengthy and sometimes expensive. But what I show in the book in the introduction is that, in fact, the federal data shows 2.1% of teachers lose their jobs due to cause annually about. And Doug, you actually helped me analyze some of these numbers about a year ago when I was writing the book. I don't know if you remember, but you sort of referred me to some, you know, comparable numbers from the private sector that actually seem to suggest that there's more turnover due to bad teachers in public schools than there is turnover, you know, due to firings in the private sector. So we have this idea that teachers are so much safer than other workers, and, you know, that may not be true.
And then what about the carrot part? You mentioned this a little bit earlier, but let's draw it out. Merit pay, does that have any good effect?
Well, actually, I think that it makes sense to differentiate teachers' pay a little more. One of the places I discuss in the book is North Carolina, where it takes 15 years to move a teacher's salary just from $30,000 to $40,000. So this extremely flat pay scale we see for teachers when they're in their 20s and 30s differentiates teachers in many ways from other white-collar professions. And it has, you know, a bad effect on retention and attracting people to the job because teachers see flat salaries while their college-educated peers are climbing the ladder. So I think we can reward teachers, but it can't be for test scores. That's going to, you know, bring a lot of negative externalities into the classroom. It's going to make test prep the de facto curriculum in many schools. You can reward teachers for mentoring one another, for getting involved with building the curriculum. There's all sorts of ways that we can build some sort of performance pay into the profession that are more sophisticated than what is being tried right now in many districts.
The current wave of education reform was launched early in the Reagan administration with the Nation at Risk report. Remind us of that history and its influence.
Yeah, so we see that Ronald Reagan runs for president vowing to shutter the Department of Education, which he considers this, you know, bureaucratic boondoggle started by President Carter. But he appoints this relative moderate to be his Secretary of Education named Harold Bell. Bell is actually sort of a closeted supporter of New Deal and Great Society social programs. and he wants to shift the conversation away from calls to shutter the Department of Education. So he appoints this committee of thought leaders, and they come down with this report, A Nation at Risk. And it basically makes the argument that we need to support our public school system and fund our public schools at the federal level because the schools are failing. And he compares American schools to our sort of Cold War opponent schools in Japan and Russia, and he finds that we're failing, especially in math and science, and really the blame on this is put on teachers. And what a lot of the states do in response to A Nation at Risk is institute big standardized testing pushes.
So then some years later, we get No Child Left Behind, right?
Yeah, so No Child Left Behind flows directly out of the Nation at Risk reforms. What it does is it asks all the states to do what two-thirds of the states had done, which is create a state-level standardized testing, and it requires states to test kids in first or eighth grade, in math and reading, once in high school, a couple times in science. So, you know, with all this data that comes in, there begins to be a much more fine-grained picture of how kids are doing, and also pressure on schools to raise these scores lest they be declared failing, which was the stick that was built into that legislation.
And I believe we're now in the year 2014 when we're all supposed to be above average or something, right?
Right, yeah. This was the year that 100% of American kids were supposed to be proficient, quote unquote. And, you know, what I say in the book is it's a beautiful idea that's, of course, completely ridiculous. You know, it's like, you know, Lake will be gone. We can't all be above average.
But proficiency, I mean, we could define proficiency in ways that are very flattering, right?
Yeah. I mean, what we thought was No Child Left Behind is that what it meant to be proficient in Massachusetts was completely different than what it meant to be proficient in Mississippi. And this is why this was such a sort of flawed piece of legislation. And, you know, Barack Obama was really aware of the flaws of No Child Left Behind. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why he incentivized the Common Core. He wanted, you know, states to all have rigorous Massachusetts-level standards so that you could make comparisons between Massachusetts and Mississippi.
Yeah, now this Common Core you mentioned earlier, it gets opposition from both left and right. The right, who thinks that the federal government has no business in education, and left, who thinks children should be spontaneous or something, I don't know. You think it's not a bad thing in principle?
Well, I think in theory it's a good thing because, you know, I've actually written a profile of one of the architects of the standards, David Coleman, and while I was preparing that piece, which ran in The Atlantic about 2 years ago, I really dove into the standards themselves, and I found that some of the things that they were asking kids to do, like write argument-driven essays that are backed with evidence, or efforts to kind of streamline our math curriculum so that kids can get more in-depth and we're not just rushing through topics one after the other, which is one way that American math is different than math taught in more successful nations. You know, these are good ideas. I think a lot of the controversy about the core comes from the high-stakes tests that are going to be attached to it. The fact that as the core rolled out, we saw, like, in New York, two-thirds of the kids were failing, and this was, you know, sort of a shock to the system. And, you know, teachers have been asked to implement this thing really quickly with very little funding and support for retraining them. So, you know, like a lot of good ideas in practice, it hasn't been as good as it could have been in theory.
Polls, I think, show that most people agree that the school system is in crisis, yet they like their own local schools. How do you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like how people feel about their own congressperson as opposed to Congress in general. If you ask Americans in polls, do you respect teachers, they say yes. And actually the only profession that scores higher is medical doctors. So Americans have a pretty positive view of teachers, but there's a political, rhetorical conversation about failing teachers and failing schools that goes back to A Nation at Risk. And we see President Obama in his State of the Union addresses often choose teaching as the only job category that he's going to criticize as failing in these big national moments. So even though I think people have this instinctual feeling that I respect the teachers I know and I respect the role of the teacher, we're affected by this political level conversation about failing schools that is ongoing and constant.
Are we a nation at risk? Are the schools as bad as some people say?
Well, if you look internationally, American schools are average. We're about average in reading, a little bit below average in math. We're not a failure as a nation, but we're not a world leader. You know, some people would say that because we're such a diverse country and we have so much poverty, one-fifth of children living in poverty, that it would be difficult to expect more. I look at the lack of rigor and anti-intellectualism in the school system, and I, you know, conclude that we could do a lot better. One of the ways that I think we can do better is to make sure that we're sharing best practices from teacher to teacher and building a collaborative system where good practices are seeded from the bottom up as opposed to imposed from the top down, because we have such a decentralized education system in this country. You know, our federal government does not control local schools and really has no power to implement many of the reforms that they're pushing on local schools. So this top-down movement has not worked to improve outcomes.
So what might work? I mean, you said like this bottom-up collegial peer-to-peer sharing, perhaps. I mean, what other things might make for a better education reform agenda than the high-stakes testing?
Yeah, well, you see that teachers in the United States don't spend much time with other adults, but they spend more time than teachers in other countries in front of kids. And so this kind of prevents the sharing of best practices that I suggest in the book, because teachers are not spending time watching one another work. You know, a lot of teachers are teaching the way they themselves were taught, you know, 20, 30 years ago. So it prevents new ideas from coming into the profession. I think it makes sense for teachers in their 20s and 30s to look forward to more jumps in pay, whether that means restructuring raises so that, you know, you can achieve more of them earlier in your career, or restructuring overall school budgets so that we spend less money on things that don't matter and more money on things that do, like recruiting, training, retaining great teachers. You know, I suggest that we look at both housing policy and school policy to look at integration. You know, we talked before about how integration has worked to improve achievement for kids. We see more and more leaders in the charter school movement acknowledging this. You know, waiving charter school lotteries so that the population of kids that go to a school are not just high-poverty kids, but middle-class kids alongside high-poverty kids. You can do a lot with, you know, housing policy to make sure that neighborhoods are not segregated. So, you know, I end the book with 11 big ideas. I think that there are so many things we could be doing that, you know, would work better than this constant pressure on test scores, which is the dominant strategy right now.
It seems like an awful lot of reforms are trying to accomplish a major transformation without spending money. Is there really a way to improve the educational system that doesn't involve paying teachers better?
No, I mean, I do think teachers need to be paid better. I look in the book at the median teacher pay. It's about $54,000 per year. It's very low. And listeners, even if teachers in your district can earn a six-figure salary, I think this national median is really important because it affects who does the job and who stays in the job long-term. A lot of the reforms, for example, Teach of America or the charter school sector, they have a huge influx of philanthropic dollars. So a lot of the schools that are talked about as successes, for example, the KIPP schools, they're not playing with the same amount of money as a neighborhood public school. They have more.
That was Dana Goldstein, author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession, just out from Doubleday, a deeply researched and nicely written history of education politics in the U.S. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. I was some of Another Brick in the Wall by Pink Floyd. Sorry, I just couldn't help myself. I learned the other day, though, that some years ago, David Gilmour, the guitarist and vocalist for the band, was dismayed by the education that the children from his first marriage were getting at a Steiner Waldorf school in Britain. He found the loose, non-hierarchical system too slack and patchy, and insisted that they be transferred to more traditional schools. So don't believe everything you hear on an LP. Next, Christian Parenti. Christian teaches political economy at NYU and is the author most recently of Tropic of Chaos from Nation Books, a study of climate change, state collapse, and war. He has a piece in the Jacobin magazine website, jacobinmag.com, called Reading Hamilton from the Left. Parenti and Hamilton's ideological antagonist is Thomas Jefferson, who still has a broad appeal on both left and right in the U.S. for his professed anti-statism and decentered view of politics. Christian Parenti. Thomas Jefferson's a curious figure because he has fans both on the left and right ends of the political spectrum. Tea Party people love Jefferson. But also you see a lot of leftists, even far leftists, who also admire Jefferson. Michael Hart, for example. You're not the biggest fan.
No, I'm not a big fan of Jefferson. I mean, Jefferson said a lot of radical things, and it's not that there isn't any value in those radical moments, but he was unrealistic on economic issues. And so what I tried to do in this piece was recuperate the kind of, you know, the Hamiltonian developmentalism. There are plenty of quotes from Jefferson that embody a kind of spirit of resistance, and that's why we like him. When Shays' Rebellion happened and he was in Paris, he had a correspondence with Abigail Adams and in which he said, I hope they let these guys off because the tree of liberty needs to be manured by the blood of patriots and tyrants every once in a while. So he had these really great lines that embody certain truths. But overall, he was about states' rights, and he was, you know, a plantation owner. And sort of within states' rights, there is plantation rights. And that was, like, in many ways, the key political unit from which he came, Monticello. He was a plantation owner. He had, at any one time, you know, 140 to 200 slaves at Monticello. So he opposed Hamilton's efforts to create a strong federal government, which isn't without problems, a strong federal government. But Hamilton wanted to create a strong federal government so as to develop the economy because he was worried that the country would fall apart. And you have to remember that after the Revolutionary War, I mean, even during the Revolutionary War, the country was weak and fragmented. And Hamilton was an aide-de-camp to Washington. He was at Valley Forge with Washington. And at that time, the Continental Congress was operating under the loose Articles of Confederation, which the Constitution later supersedes. And the Continental Congress would impose taxes on states to pay for the Continental military, and they just wouldn't pay up. So people were going hungry, soldiers were, you know, dying as a result of this. So Hamilton had an object lesson during the war in the vulnerabilities of disorganization and decentralization. The southern elites, plantation owners, were from the very beginning very wary of a strong federal government because they were ultimately afraid that it would take their slaves away. Even at the birth of this country, there was open discussion of possible disunion around the issue of slavery.
Let's talk some about Jefferson. You make the point in the article that the consciousness that is produced by being a slave owner really is key to what Jefferson is all about politically, right?
Yeah. He lived in a world where everything was taken care of for him. I mean, he was delivered as an infant from his father's first plantation to the second plantation on a pillow carried by a slave. He had everything taken care of for him by slaves, and he bought books and couches and wine from Paris and wrote about the nobility of the yeoman farmer, the small independent producer, while living off the labor of enslaved people.
So he was very calculating about exactly what the return was. It was this capitalist consciousness applied to this slave-holding labor structure.
Yeah, as you put it, Barbara Field, who says that you can sort of watch Jefferson
Inventing race.
Yeah, inventing race, as he's describing. Yeah, I mean, he was very calculating in relationship to making money off of his slaves. So he at one point had a nail factory. So even as he wrote about how evil manufacturing was and how the workmen of Europe were degraded in their morals and how we export our goods to Europe and import their finished commodities, export our raw commodities, import their finished goods, he was himself operating a factory that sold nails to the Baltimore and Philadelphia market. He was very calculating. He was a sort of, you know, a capitalist slave owner in that regard, and also very much a sort of proto-scientific racist. His racism wasn't just the standard prejudice of the slave owning class. If you read the Notes on the State of Virginia, he has this kind of pseudo-scientific discussion of the differences between the races that Corey Robin, who's frequently on your show, and listeners probably read his work, made a point recently about that this really anticipates scientific races, and this isn't just kind of, regular old prejudice.
Yeah, he was very much an intellectual of the Enlightenment,
mm-hmm.
and lived like one, and developed his theories of freedom, but on a foundation of slavery.
Yes.
Hamilton, of course, had a very different resume.
Hamilton was born in the Caribbean. He was an illegitimate child. He was orphaned at age 13. He went to work as a clerk, and he began writing as a young teenager, and local notables in St. Croix took an interest in him because he was really brilliant and raised money to send him to Columbia, what's now Columbia University, before that a prep school in New Jersey. So Hamilton had all along this experience of weakness and the danger of vulnerability and weakness. And he had a very instrumentalist relationship to power. He didn't like Washington, but because of Hamilton's brains and his valor, he fought very bravely.
Well, he found Washington, what did you say, crass and dull?
Yeah, but he stuck close by Washington because it was a source of power that Hamilton could use. And so he understood the utility of power. So out of the experience of his own vulnerability as an orphan, an immigrant, somebody without any property, unlike Jefferson, he didn't inherit anything. All he inherited from his mother were some books. So he was very much a self-made man, which means he had to connect himself to institutions, and he understood the importance of institutions. And so he wanted to create a strong federal government. During the war, people like Jefferson were going back to their states. Jefferson went back to Virginia and wasn't alone in that. There were officers in the Continental Army who, when things were getting rough, went to their state militias. So everywhere there were signs that this whole project could fall apart. So Hamilton exits at the end of the war with this deep concern about the fragility of the country, which was completely founded, well-founded and correct, right? Because the country does later split apart in a horrific civil war. So he tries to create a strong federal government. In this essay, I'm not unconditionally supportive of Hamilton's politics, but what I find really interesting and really important for us today is how sophisticated and explicit his economic ideas were. And what they were was essentially about how exactly to use state power to build a manufacturing economy. And he wanted to do this so as to defend against national disintegration and invasion and to build a large and strong, prosperous economy. He was not a progressive in the sense that we would think of it. He accepted child labor as normal.
But he was anti-slavery.
Yes, he was definitely anti-slavery. He was the only founding father who didn't personally or buy and sell slaves. Even Franklin sold some slaves. It does seem, though, that Hamilton's wife inherited two slaves, servants that were probably slaves from her family. He married into a big landed family from the Hudson Valley. But he was the most progressive founding father on slavery, and he helped form the Society for the Manumission of Slaves. Ironically, Aaron Burr was also a founding member of that.
And we should have noted at the outset that we've just passed the 200th anniversary of the death of Hamilton at Burr's hand, right?
Yes, yeah.
And that was not just a personal dispute, though. There were politics behind that.
Correct. Burr represented the anti-federalist forces in New York, and Hamilton was a really brilliant and vicious writer. And Jefferson writes about this, but what a great and vicious pen Hamilton has. And Hamilton was attacking and mocking Burr, and Burr demanded satisfaction, and Hamilton refused to apologize. And this escalated, per the Code Duel, to a duel. And a similar thing had happened to Hamilton's oldest son, who was very promising and had 2 years earlier had insulted some Jeffersonian anti-federalist young politician at the theater, and that escalated into a duel in which Hamilton advised his son to delope, as it was called, which is to throw away your shot, essentially preserve your honor by exposing yourself to the risk of being shot, but make it clear to your opponent that you're not going to kill them. And Hamilton's son was killed. And then it seems that Hamilton actually was planning to delope as well with Burr, but he aimed his pistol at Burr beforehand. He gave too many signals to Burr that he intended to kill Burr, and so at the moment of the duel, it's not clear who shot first, and Hamilton's bullet did go up above Burr, and Burr shot Hamilton through the side, and it took Hamilton, I think, about 24 hours to die. And this was all illegal, and so they rode across the Hudson to Weehawken, New Jersey, to have this duel. And Burr at the time was the vice president, but was running for Senate in New York.
Oh, I'm speaking with Christian Prenti, who's got a piece in Jacobin magazine about rethinking Hamilton from the left. Getting back to Hamilton's economic development theories, today we would call it something like a nationalist developmentalist strategy. But he did have an influence in subsequent thinking, right, in Europe and Asia?
Yes. So there's actually a book by someone named Ian Austin, who's an Australian business professor, and I didn't know about this book. And he read the article and got in touch with me and said, he's actually written a whole book about this, which I have yet to read. But it was in reading Han Jun Chang, the South Korean economist, who is a champion of the developmentalist state, who's written several books on how capitalism relies upon an interventionist state and protection, that he, in a footnote, mentioned that all this goes back to Hamilton. And so that's how I got interested in it. And sure enough, you look at Hamilton's writings, particularly the report on manufacturers. He did a series of reports, but what's considered to be his economic magnum opus is the report on manufacturers, in which he lays out his theory of an economically activist government and then offers some very specific policies. He begins that document by discussion of value. He takes on the physiocrats, who were early political economists, French political economists in the 18th century, who argued that all value really came from agriculture and that manufacturing was really just parasitic upon agriculture. So Hamilton begins with a discussion of how the physiocrats are wrong, which is essentially, you read between the lines, he's speaking to the South. He's talking to the agrarian section of the economy and trying to disabuse them of their inflated self-importance. And he then goes in and deals with Adam Smith without naming Smith or with naming the physiocrats, but it's clear that's who he's talking about, and makes the case that laissez-faire economics aren't going to work for a small, what we would say, essentially underdeveloped economy like the U.S., and that what's needed is a different policy, a policy in which the government takes an active role in building manufacturing. And so he proposes tariff on imported goods so as to protect infant industries in the U.S., direct subsidies to those industries. He sort of outlines a kind of theory of military Keynesianism. He calls for and helps champion and create a publicly chartered and partially publicly owned bank, and calls for public investment in internal improvements, building infrastructure, canals and roads and ports. And at every turn, this agenda was opposed by the plantation elite in the South, because as Nathaniel Macon of North Carolina put it, he was one of the only ones who would say it explicitly and get frustrated with Southern politicians who didn't understand why the federal government should be opposed so much. And he said in one letter, look, if Congress can build canals, they can, with just as much propriety, emancipate. So there was a fear of the slippery slope, that if the government were given the power to pursue this Hamiltonian developmentalist agenda, that the South's peculiar institution could be attacked, which it eventually was. And it was unpopular at the time. The Adams, who were friends with Jefferson, but they were scandalized by the fact that Jefferson owned slaves, and they wouldn't be around him in the presence of his slaves, it seems. When he went to visit them, he wouldn't bring his slaves because they were just totally disgusted by this. The plantation elites felt threatened, and that's part of why they oppose the federal government.
This, of course, is all interesting in itself, but the argument you're putting, the purpose you're putting to the present day is talking about the climate crisis. And to be crude about it, we need more Hamilton and less Jefferson.
Yes. Part of what I was responding to is the kind of anarcho-liberalism of the left, which assumes that government is only part of the problem, which government very much frequently is part of the problem. I've written books about that, about, police repression. But that's not the only thing it is. It can also be, in terms of developing the economy, very essential. And it seems to me that we have to, in the short run, get off fossil fuels, and that that alone doesn't take care of all environmental problems, but it's just going to, you know, it's necessary to buy time to deal with other issues. And that the science is very clear on this. We don't have that much time to do this. And it seems to me the only way that that can happen is not through any kind of voluntarist efforts or just sort of, you know, convincing the capitalist class to turn its back on fossil fuels, but that the government has to, in many ways, remake the economy as it did originally. It helped through the Hamiltonian developmentalist agenda. It helped build the economy and launch it. And that's what a transition off fossil fuels would require. I mean, we're talking about what would be a major, major program of economic development. Even if in the long run the solution to the climate crisis and the environmental crisis requires less consumption, et cetera, in the short term, replacing this energy infrastructure with anything that's going to keep society together means a massive project of economic development. That capitalism can't do that on its own. It doesn't, it hasn't, it won't. So part of the argument is to say, look, this idea of an activist state and a mixed economy isn't as foreign as many people think. It's the real story of American capitalism. It's the real story of capitalism globally. I mean, capitalism does not develop without the assistance of the state, without the protection, the discipline, the subsidies, and the you know, the risk taking of the state. And you had on your show, the author of The Entrepreneurial State,
Mariana Mazzucato.
Yeah,
yeah,
that excellent book, and addresses this much more directly in terms of what would be required to develop green technology.
Now, but also, now you see in the climate movement, liberals, radicals, progressives, people, you know, of many political stripes, really turning to things like divestment, using market mechanisms, private, outside the state. It's as if they've given up on, either are philosophically hostile to the state or have given it up on it as a lost territory. And your argument is that we're not going to get anywhere doing that.
Yeah, we're not. Yeah. And it's a combination of both. They're philosophically hostile and therefore have given up on it and therefore don't have very sophisticated politics vis-a-vis the state. What's interesting is you'll see European states, particularly Germany, which has made broad investments in renewable energy, and on a sunny, windy day, more than 70% of the electricity in the German grid is from clean power. Similarly, Portugal and Spain sometimes reach that level of renewable energy in their grid. So those countries will be invoked without ever having a discussion about, well, what was it that created that? And what it was specific government policies. A feed-in tariff in Germany passed in 1991 when the German utilities were focused on reunification, and the Greens got some seats in parliament, and they made an alliance with Social Democrats and some right-wing parties in Bavaria that represented hydro interests, and they passed this clean feed-in tariff law that paid a subsidy to anyone who could produce clean energy and push it into the grid, and also allowed any energy producer to use the grid and to sell energy into the grid. That and other policies are why Germany has achieved this. It's not just that there's something about the Germans, it's something specific about the German state helped German capitalism do this.
It's also interesting that private capital, I'm thinking Munich Reinsurance, is one of the few financial entities that actually shows any concern about the climate. And the impact on the insurance industry, they're very concerned about what it's going to do to them, increased storms and disasters. It's as if even the business consciousness can't be transformed if the state isn't prodding it.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And I mean, and unfortunately, you know, what most insurance companies have done, their solution to climate crisis is to just stop insuring risky property, to just evacuate from the coasts. And early on, environmentalists thought, okay, the insurance industry is going to be the weak link. They're going to have to come on side and take the climate issue seriously and pressure the rest of capital to deal with this. But no, their solution was just don't insure property that risks being wiped out by hurricanes. So yeah, the capital cannot do this without the prodding of the state. And the state isn't going to do this if the environmental movement doesn't articulate what it should do, why it should do it, and how we should proceed. And currently in the U.S., by and large, we don't really have a sophisticated conversation about what government can do, what it has done, and how we can get it to do more.
And as you point out often, we have the legislation in the form of the Clean Air Act to do an awful lot about climate.
Yes.
And it's a matter of enforcing it.
Yep. And
we don't need new legislation. We don't need this, you know, comprehensive climate legislation that the Climate March people are talking about. We just need to use existing laws properly.
Correct. Yeah. I don't think that the Climate March is actually calling for comprehensive climate legislation. They're calling for an international climate agreement, which I think is fair. Okay, call for a international climate agreement. It's probably not going to happen. If it does happen, the Senate won't ratify it because it didn't ratify Kyoto, and Kyoto didn't really achieve the only emissions reductions Kyoto achieved were achieved by the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that led to some reductions for Russia. But where the transition is actually happening is within national economies, where that's such as Germany and Spain that I already mentioned, China, where there are state policies that are channeling capital towards building out clean energy, and most importantly, consuming clean energy. So part of the thing that we have to do here is we have to not just create clean energy sources, but we have to create a market for clean energy, right? So we have to demand that institutions consume clean energy so as to help the producers of clean technology, clean energy, and vehicles achieve economies of scale.
And of course, the biggest consumer of energy in the world is the U.S. government, right?
Correct. And it has enormous vehicle fleets, enormous building fleets, and its consumption could be a very, very important tool for pushing the whole economy towards a transition off of fossil fuels. So the key thing to remember is we have the law. It's the Clean Air Act as passed by Nixon and modified later by Bush, and then modified later by Massachusetts versus EPA, which was a case brought by Massachusetts and some green groups that said the EPA must, according to the language of the Clean Air Act, regulate greenhouse gas emissions because they're harmful to human health. So that one, the Supreme Court said yes. So we have been waiting ever since 2007 for a whole slew of rules to be issued from that. We've gotten a few. We've gotten one about new power plants. And because of the collapse in energy prices due to fracking, that was politically easy for Obama to do. So they set emissions levels for new coal-fired power plants that are so high that there basically won't be any new coal-fired power plants. And then this year, there is a process of hearings that the EPA is having about the rules for existing coal-fired power plants. And the Sierra Club is involved with this. Unfortunately, NRDC, which is, you know, generally quite willing to water down the Clean Air Act, is also involved. But many of the more radical environmental groups, this isn't even really on their radar because the state is not taken seriously. The state is seen as broken, and there are these anarcho-liberal kind of romantic notions of community-based solutions, or type of voluntarist politics of divestment in which institutions can be forced to drive a transformation by investing in clean technology. But the point, you know, one point about that is that those investing in clean technology alone will not create the markets that are needed for that technology to be profitable. If there isn't a market to consume all that energy, then you just get more bankruptcies. And there have been some major bankruptcies. I think both Vestas and Gamesa, big wind manufacturers, went into bankruptcy. There's the famous Solyndra case. What is that a result of? That's a result of essentially having too much capital, not being able to realize the investment. So we need to be demanding clean consumption, and the government can do that. And that's part of the story of this, you know, the hidden developmental estate in the U.S., that the government helps bring technology to market not only by funding its R&D, but also, very importantly, by consuming it. And that then allows the producers of this technology to achieve savings that then make the technology competitive and on the open market. This has happened with high technology, with aviation, unfortunately during war, with automobiles and medicine. There's a way in which the government is the first consumer, and it's through that mass consumption that technological revolutions are born, in part.
So to do that, though, we have to exercise the political influence of the ghostly slave owner Jefferson, right?
We do. We have to take a serious look at what the capitalist state does. And what I argue in this piece is that for capitalism, there has never been and there never will be an outside of the state. And that, I think, gives us a lot of leverage, and it's something that the left and environmentalists could use much more than we do now. The fact that capital is ultimately beholden to the state and dependent on it.
That was Christian Parenti, author of Reading Hamilton from the Left, which you can find on the Jacobin magazine website, jacobinmag.com. His latest book is Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change, and the New Geography of Violence from Nation Books. That's it from me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a song about the town where Alexander Hamilton met his end, Weehawken, New Jersey. Thanks to the great X-Ray Burns of WFMU for passing along this gem of a song to me, Sweet-Talkin' Weehawken Woman by the Reverend Jim D. I know nothing more about him or the song than that. Till next week, bye.
Well, she walks into town, sets him up to knock him down. Everybody wears a frown when this girl comes around. She says to me she can set me free. In the same breath she says that we could never be as one. We're having so much fun. She's a sweet-talking, weehawking woman, walking and talking round town. Sweet-talking, weehawking woman, likes to set 'em up, to knock 'em down.